Up next, from PopTech 2005, a presentation by Susan Blackmore in the session entitled The Future of Ideas from IT Conversations. Hello, this is Doug Kay, the executive producer of IT Conversations, and today I'm excited to bring you another presentation from PopTech 2005, held October 19th through 22nd in Camden, Maine. Registered members of the Conversations Network receive a wide variety of benefits. For free membership or to help support our efforts through your donations, visit conversationsnetwork.org. Our audio content is delivered by Limelight Networks, taking the cost and complexity out of internet distribution on the web at limelightnetworks.com. And now, here's our presentation from PopTech 2005.
We are now going to hear from Sue Blackmore. Sue has done more than virtually anyone in the world to explore, popularize, share, and spread the idea of memetics. She's the author of a half dozen important books on the subject, exploring everything from memetics to the future of consciousness. And she's authored some 40 academic and scientific papers and book reviews, countless reviews, and she's an extraordinary thinker on where our ideas and where memes will go next. So will you please join me in welcoming Sue Blackmore.
So, good afternoon, everybody. You know, I knew this was a special kind of audience when first morning I turned up, and there's Andrew saying, hello, and everybody replied. Gives you a great sense of power. So, I'm going to exploit my power mercilessly by trying to turn your minds inside out, to get you to see the world in a completely different way. Of course, it's frightening to have your world turned inside out. I'd like to assure you that you can turn it back very, very easily afterwards. I hope that's true. Maybe it's not. That's my task today. I say this with a serious intent, because it is very easy to just reject memetics straight out like that. Oh, it's an empty analogy, or as Stephen Jay Gould used to say, it's a meaningless metaphor. I don't think you can actually have a meaningless metaphor, can you? But that's what he said. And don't do that. See if you can just go with me far enough to take this mental flip and see the world from a meme's eye point of view, and then evaluate it. Then come back and tell me what's wrong with it. I think the idea is the way we need to look at the world and at humans' place in it, but I'm not sure. I want to know, is it scientifically viable? Is it useful? Will it be testable? Is it going to help us to solve some of the problems of the planet? So come with me further through the arguments and then fight back and see where we get to. Now, I was asked by Andrew to talk about the future of memetics. So I went to the only journal of memetics recently, and this is what I saw. So maybe memetics has no future. There are an awful lot of scientists who think it's a load of rubbish, and we should stop now. Stephen Jay Gould's not the only one. Well, I battle on anyway, because I think they're wrong, and we can manage without a journal. We just have to go about it the right way. So, I need to go back to the beginning and explain to you what on earth I'm talking about. Now, I know some of you here have already done this flip. I've heard some of you talking about memes, but I need to know who I'm talking to. So, be truthful and honest, please. Hands up who knows loads and loads about memes. Good, about a dozen or so of you. Okay, hands up who knows something about memes, what they are, general idea. Excellent, about a bit more than half. And hands up people who have no idea, don't even know what the word means. Right, okay, good. Well, I apologize to you experts, but maybe no harm going through the basics again. I'm going to start at the beginning. And the beginning is this wonderful book, Richard Dawkins' The Selfish Gene. Hands up who's read The Selfish Gene. Good. All of you who haven't, shame on you. It's 30 years old, but, you know, I know a lot of you are authors here. You authors, do you go and look in Amazon and see what number your book's got to? Yeah? Well, if you go and look at The Selfish Gene, 30 years old, and it's still up there in the hundreds. I mean, 100 and something, you know? incredible. It deserves that. It's an amazing book. Now, what Richard was doing in that book, this is 1976 we're talking, was popularizing what was then becoming, and has since proved itself to be, a very powerful idea in evolutionary biology, which is that evolution doesn't proceed for the sake of the species, nor even for the sake of the individual body. It works for the sake of the genes, the replicators, the units of information that are copied. That's what the book is all about, how we should see things from the gene's eye view. Underlying this is the principle of what might be called the evolutionary algorithm. I'm sure you know how this works, but it's so fundamental, I'm not going to apologize for explaining it again. Take something, anything. I need something, give me something. Oh, lovely, thank you very much. Right, this'll do. We've got this lovely jacket here. Okay, take a jacket. Now, make a dozen copies, all slightly different. The color varies a bit, the sleeves are longer, the pocket, okay? Make lots of copies. Now, try them out on a whole lot of people and kill off nearly all the copies and choose the one that people like best, or that keeps them warmest, or that looks sexiest. I don't care what it is, whatever. Kill the rest off. Take the new one. Let's say the new one is a bit redder than this and it's got longer arms. You know. Take that one. Now make a dozen copies of that one. Kill off 11 of them. Copy that one. What happens? What happens is natural selection. According to which ones get killed off, let's say it's really, really hot in here. Well, it's going to get thinner material, isn't it? Let's say it's freezing in here. Well, it's going to get a wonderful furry collar. You know, as long as you've got a source of variation and you kill off most things, you will get design out of nowhere without the aid of mind, as the philosopher Dan Dennett puts it. This is the principle known as the evolutionary algorithm. Note the word "you must get evolution." Do you see how powerful this is? It's inevitable. Once you get it, you see that it has to happen. I just don't understand these intelligent designs. I'm sorry, it's very peculiar for me coming from a country where we don't have creationism. We don't have intelligent design. We're not wasting all our time on these dreadful arguments. To understand, do people not see that? Well, I think that's right. I think actually, although when I explain it like this, it's absolutely obvious, isn't it? But you could sort of muddle it up. It's actually quite scary. Darwin was scared of this idea. I mean, basically in The Origin of Species, Darwin, I'm paraphrasing him, but 1859, he said something like this, you know, if you have a whole lot of creatures that vary, and this cannot be doubted, I've been to the Galapagos and I've measured the sizes of wings of finches and blah, 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 blah. And if there is a struggle for life such that most of the creatures die, which cannot be doubted, I've read Malthus and I've studied the propagation of elephants and blah, 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 blah. And if the very few survivors pass on whatever it was that helped them to survive to their offspring, then the offspring must be better adapted to the circumstances in which all that occurred than their parents were. That's putting it properly. That's quite complicated. But with that coat, I can show it simply. Now, back to this inevitability. You see how it has to be like that. It's not even like, I don't know, Newton's laws of motion or something, where you can say, well, why is the universe that way? You just, once you get it, you see it's got to be. So, design comes out of nowhere without the aid of mind. That's the principle. But in this book, The Selfish Gene, Dawkins wanted to say something else very important, which is this: don't get hooked up on genes. It's not really about genes, it's about replicators in general. It's about this principle. And this principle will work wherever you have information that is copied with variation and selection. And so he said, are there any other replicators on this planet? Yes, he said. Look around you. Look around this lecture theatre. Here, still swimming around in the primeval soup of culture, is a new replicator. Every time I copy an idea to you, every time that jacket is, new ones are produced in the factory, every time a picture is reproduced, we are copying information with variation and selection. It's the same process. We're the meme machines, and we're copying the information. Let's call that the memes. So a meme often said to be a unit of cultural transmission or a unit of imitation. Don't get hooked on units, they're often not units. That's not the point. The point is, it's that which is copied, that which is imitated. He took the word from the Greek mimeme, which means that which is imitated. So that's the fundamental definition of a meme, is anything that is imitated. So he gave us examples, stories, songs, technologies, games, theories. You could say this lecture is a memeplex, a complex of memes operating together, tied together as a lecture, being put out to you, taking its chances in the world. Will any of these memes be passed on or not? I come across all sorts of odd memes, and it's extraordinary how far they spread. Oh, a little quirky one that I rather enjoyed. I arrive here at my hotel, lovely hotel just up the road here, and I go into the bathroom, and the toilet paper has been, you know, made into a little triangle at the end. It's so sweet. You know, is this supposed to sort of prove that it's clean or something? Am I supposed to believe the person who folded it up had less germs than whoever used the toilet paper before? Or do they rip some off before they do it? Am I supposed to? I don't know. Well, I wasn't very surprised to see that. But I was recently in an eco camp in the jungle in Assam. And there it was again. It's extraordinary how far a little quirk like that can travel. But think of this, what this means. This is a behavior or skill or story or something, isn't it? It's information, it's a behavior that has spread all around the world with consequences. They're not very serious consequences in this case. We'll come to some where they are. Or another funny example, I was up in a pass in the far north of India, and there's a hut there, and the wind's howling outside, and I've got my anorak on, open the door, slam the door. And this is on the back of the door. We have a Hindu god, and then underneath the Hindu god we have, do you recognize this? Buckingham Palace, you got it in one, well done. Who knows? It's labeled, it says up there, it's a bit, you know, it's even labeled, yes? Yes? So, they're gods, fine, that's fine by me. So, the basic principle, and then you know enough to get going. This is all the kind of introduction, and you know enough to get going. Memes are replicators. Information that is copied with variation and section, such that an evolutionary process must take place. And we, meme machines, are doing the copying. So the question that you have to ask of any replicator is which ones are going to be successful. So imagine a world full of brains and far more memes than can find homes. Which ones are going to be successful? This room will do. Here we have a room full of brains, very, very clever, intelligent, meme sucking up, copying, and spouting out brains. Which memes are going to be successful at getting into your brains and getting passed on again? Well, it's a huge selection pressure. Just think about when you got up this morning. It's probably not as bad here as it is at home when you get up at home. I mean, think of my day at home. I get up in the morning and I turn on the radio. There's the news, blah, 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 all these wars happening and all these things happening. Some of it I remember, some I don't. My partner says, oh, was there anything on the news? And I go, blah, blah, blah. Sometimes I remember it. Then I go down to breakfast. There's cornflakes, packets and toad things, all writing on them. Blah, you know, eat this, do you know, whatever. And then I go to my study and then, oh my God, turn on the computer. Emails, phone rings, hello, yes, yes. Oh, the postman's there, hello, hello, morning Fred, yes. Lovely, thank you very much. Oh, more letters, reply to this, you do that, go off, give a lecture. It's memes all day. And I even work at home, I don't go out. What if I went in the tube in London? Advert. Now, those are all there trying to use you to get themselves propagated. That's the memes I view. So the question is, which ones are going to succeed at using you? Why have these succeeded? Why have they got up there? Look around you. Any example where you want to look, ask, how did that get there and why? Who copied it and why? Why did that succeed against all the competition? The general principle, I suppose, could be this. Some memes succeed because they are good or true or useful or beautiful. In that case, you as the meme machine are doing a good job for yourself. You always have to think, for whose benefit? Because the memes are just selfish replicators. An aside here, the selfish gene, as I'm sure you know, genes are just bits of information in DNA. They're not going around going, I want, I want, I want. They're selfish in the sense that they'll get copied if they can, regardless of the consequences. That's what's meant by selfish. Same with memes. Memes are just, you know, this is a meme. Blah, 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 that's a meme. That's not going around saying anything at all. But it'll get copied if it can, regardless of the consequences for me, for you, for my genes, for the planet. Now, from your point of view, if you copy memes that are good or true or useful or beautiful, they're good memes for you, but not necessarily for the meme's point of view. From the meme's point of view, they might get copied for other reasons. They use tricks to get into your brain and get passed on. Who's had this one in their email? Well, it's just as bad as some of the things Sam's been telling us about, isn't it? Hands up, who's had that one? Yes, well, wasn't that a successful memeplex? Somebody wrote it, presumably, or maybe it was adapted from prior memeplexes. Why did it succeed? Tell me why so many of you, I'm in a different country, I'm not at home now. I put this thing up here and I come here and half the audience has seen this thing. That's a very successful meme. Why did it succeed? Let's have some reasons. Yeah. Yes, it's got instructions to copy it and pass it on. So that's the core of it. It's like DNA in that sense. It's telling you to pass it on. What else? Yeah. It promises benefit. Note that the promise is absolutely nebulous and pathetic. You know, all your dreams will come true. Okay, what else? Pardon? It's using authority. It comes from the Dalai Lama, and especially religious authority, and we know all about that, don't you? You don't, as we've heard, you don't question that in the way that you would other things. The Dalai Lama is above questioning. So, if he says it, it's got to be true. Yep. The low cost of doing it. Now, this is rather different from traditional chain letters. I don't know about you, but I'm old enough that the first chain letter I came across, I had to make 6 copies and put my address at the top and write them all out by hand and put a stamp on and go down to the post box. That was quite a heavy investment. I still did it, mind you. But this is really easy. You can just say, send to all, and off it goes. So, easy to do. You don't count the cost, even though the cost is actually a cost to all of us in clogging up networks and using up space that could be used for better things. Yes?
It partially consists of actually good advice.
Yes, it's actually got some good stuff in it. So this is an important point I'll come back to. You know, it's not all or none. It's not all virus, parasite versus good. There's a nice mixture there. Yeah, so maybe it does some good after all. Yes?
It's a message.
Yes, we want to hear it. It plugs into those biological bases. Well, I would think they're biologically given to us of the kind of things that we like. Yes?
There are mutations in
there. Yeah, what sort of mutations?
Well, they change the message maybe on the way.
I think it does change. I've seen different versions of it. How those come about, I'm not sure I'd call them mutate. Well, yeah, let's call them that if you like. An analog of mutations, they certainly come about. And if you take something like urban legends, you know, my favorite is the poodle in the microwave. You know that wonderful story where this American woman has a poodle? And of course, you probably have some other country to give it to, but it's an American woman. And she's always dried her poodle in the oven. And then, you know, she gets one of these newfangled microwave things. And she brings it home and she, you know, a lovely dog and washes it and everything and puts it in the microwave to dry. It dies an agonizing death. Whereupon she sues the company for not putting a sign on the microwave saying, do not dry your dog in this oven. Now that comes in the poodle is absolutely the most common, but there's the cat in the microwave, there's the exploding poodle, there's other kinds of dogs, there's even the tortoise in the microwave. So these you could call mutations, I'd prefer them just to call variants, presumably created by people by word of mouth. This is harder to change because it's easy for people to just send it on intact, but presumably some people do change it. Okay, anything else about this? Yes? Pardon? Implicit threat, absolutely. The threat is not you're going to die or something terrible will happen. The threat is, oh, you won't get your dreams come true, all the things you wanted won't be. Oh, is this sort of kind of implies that you'd be a bad person if you didn't pass it on, something like that? Okay, I won't go on. I got lots more hands coming. You get the picture. So, this is a bunch, a selfish memeplex that has used all of you. Did any of you send it on? Oh, I don't believe it. But it would be too embarrassing for me to force you to raise your hands if you passed it on, wouldn't it? You get the idea. So the classic meme virus is a copy me instruction backed up with threats and promises. I want to iterate that from our point of view, not all memes are viruses, but many are. You have to think where you're looking from, whether you call something a virus or parasite, or whether you call it a helpful meme. So the basic structure is this. Well, obviously chain letters, email hoaxes. I'm sure you all had that one long ago that said, you know, pass this warning on to your friends or everything on your hard drive will be deleted. Remember that one? I mean, I was really scared of that. Everything on my hard drive will be deleted. It preyed on ignorance because most people didn't know what they know now about how it would have been impossible at that time. So, but what is the ultimate meme virus? I'm sure you can guess. With this structure, copy me instruction backed up with threats and promises? Religions. And we've just heard enough about them to see precisely that structure. I hope it will help you to think about everything that Sam has said, to think of it in these terms. As viral information using people to get itself passed on. Religions are extraordinarily effective. They've been around a long, long time. You need to think of the religions of the world not as having been designed by anybody. You know, I don't believe Jesus set out to design a religion that would last 2,000 years. Rather, think of it in evolutionary terms. Think of it that throughout human history and prehistory, there have been charismatic leaders who have popped up all over the place and got a following of 12 disciples, or 10, or 3, or 99, it doesn't matter. And most of them have fizzled out. But those who had the kind of ideas that became packaged in this memeplex structure, such that it was a copy me instruction backed up with threats and promises, they would be the ones to succeed. Now, Dawkins does a wonderful analysis in his book, The Selfish Gene, and again in later papers, in more detail, of Roman Catholicism. As I'm sure you know, he's pretty vehement about Roman Catholicism, largely because his daughter, when he split up from his wife, was educated against his will in a Catholic nunnery. And it must have been pretty painful for him to see this process happening. So he spells out what happens in Roman Catholicism. The whole memeplex is held together and passed on as a unit. This is very important. Any of you who know about evolutionary theory will see the analogy with an animal. I mean, all my genes are passed on together. You know, they don't get just the ones to produce a leg and then just a leg gets produced and another one to produce a brain. It wouldn't work. They all have to be packaged together. The same with religion. So you learn the catechism as a child. You learn all this stuff. I believe in God, the Father, whatever they believe. I don't know. All of this stuff's passed on. The threats and promises are pretty heavy duty, aren't they? I mean, what's going to happen to you if you pass it on? Have lots of children. Pass on all these ideas about the virgin birth and Jesus' lifetime and miracles and all these kinds of totally false, vacuous, either vacuous or false or dangerous or all three at once. Those ideas are protected by these rules. What's going to happen to you if you pass them all on? Heaven, yes, lovely. Actually, the Christian heaven is pretty feeble, isn't it? I mean, what are you going to do? Sit around on a cloud with nice music and be on the right hand of God forever? And get a free iPod, yay! Does he work for iPod? But what's going to happen to you if you don't? You see, that in this case, unlike the previous thing, this case marks much more by threat. It's much more to avoid the threat. So what's going to happen to you if you don't obey all of those rules?
Burn in fires in hell.
Burn in fires in hell. It's even worse than having your whole hard disk wiped out. Or is it? Or your iPod. Your iPod trampled to bits. No, I think I'll settle for the toasting forks myself, thank you. So those are the threats. It's not confined to Christianity. As we've just heard, and we've all been thinking about a lot in the recent world, Islam has even worse threats. Given the world situation, I actually took the trouble to read the Quran, in translation, of course, and it is utterly terrifying. I've sort of got used to the Old Testament. I mean, I know there's horrendous things in there, but reading afresh, you know, about the special fires being prepared for the infidel, instructions to do things, you know, don't associate with them, go and do terrible things to them if you find any infidels. Really, really dreadful. And then, of course, the promises of all these virgins. I don't know what the women get. I don't particularly like my men to be virgins. Can I have some well-trained sex hunks, please? I'll see you all afterwards. Somebody mentioned the cost of this passing on the thing. The costs of religions are not negligible. Think of the cost of building all those wonderful buildings, and of paying the priests, and of giving them money every week, and of using up all your time every Sunday or Friday or whatever day it is you're supposed to go, all that time that you give up. People tend not to count these costs. The costs are phenomenal, both in time and in money. They also pose risks to health. Here are a lot of Hindus bathing in the Ganges because it will purify them. Now, the Ganges, I'm sorry to say, once upon a time, I'm sure it was a wonderful, sparkling, clean river, but now it smells bad. It is full of sewage, and that means it is full of very nasty human being-killing germs. And they go there with, in the rain, they go there with gifts in pots, clay pots, which are all smashed on the side, so that when you walk in there, which I recently did, you're walking on broken pots, and most of them walk with bare feet. So inevitably, some of them are going to cut their feet, and the germs are going to get in. But their soul is purified. As with the previous one, as somebody pointed out, it's a mixture. The beauty is genuine. This is a picture of my favorite cathedral, Wells Cathedral in Somerset. There's something about that arch that just, I think it's wonderful. Beauty like this. I'm not saying there isn't genuine beauty, but the beauty is used as a trick to get you into the church, to infect you with the idea of God and Jesus. Now, I need to dash through a few other ideas here. Here you see me with some chimps. I want to make the point here that human beings are the only species on this planet capable of imitation. So we are the only species that can have memes. So something extraordinary happened when we first appeared on the planet. Up until that time, our planet was only inhabited by one replicator. Maybe there's a bit of RNA and a few bits and other pieces, but basically DNA had the grip of the planet. Other species, with little bits of exceptions in whales and dolphins and maybe elephants, little bits of exceptions, other species cannot imitate. So along suddenly comes Homo sapiens, starts imitating, starts passing information to and fro. A second replicator is born. Mimetic drive is the process I've described by which, once memes are around, it pays people to be able to pick up the latest memes. You could have a pretty small brain and not talk until the memes started up. But once there are memes around, once people are copying noises between each other, copying ways of lighting fire, you've got to be able to pick those up. You've got to have a slightly bigger brain. And once they start making noises that connect to the world, then you've got to start making those noises too. So an entirely new theory of the origins of language comes out of this, which is that language was there not, it evolved not for the sake of us humans, not for any purpose, which is why, in my opinion, no one has ever found an answer to the question, why did language evolve? They're arguing about it and have been arguing about it for since evolutionary theory began. It evolved for the sake of the memes. The words themselves altered the human brain to be a better machine, better meme machine. So once all this began, there was no going back. Our planet became infected with a second replicator. Now, I want to see this as a co-evolutionary process. A process in which the memes, that is the replicator, co-evolve with the machinery, that is our brains. This is a common process. Right in the beginning on this planet, genes didn't just appear out of nowhere, complete with the RNA, messenger RNA, all the ribosomes and all the other things needed. The two evolved together. Similarly, once memes came along, the human brain was reorganized, made much bigger, given language, produced into the way it is now. So what next? If memes are going to improve, they need to get higher fidelity, fecundity, longevity. So how do you get from cavemen speaking primitive language to effective memes? Any suggestions? What do you need to get longer living memes? Pardon? Storage. You need storage. Yes, like what? Oh, disk drives. Yeah, absolutely. That's a bit of a leap ahead. Let's start with writing. I mean, first of all, you get writing. And then printing presses. So you can see the printing press. You see the co-evolutionary process is once you've got a printing press, you get more books. And then when people see those books, they think, I want more of those. Oh, let's make another printing press. Oh, you've got another printing press. You make more books. They spread further. And so it goes on. And then you get roads. And then you get trains. And you get railways. And then you want to go even quicker. So you get the telegraph. So you get, well, you jump ahead. But of course, you get this. And of course, the World Wide Web and the Internet are the biggest meme machine yet created. And they're spreading, as we've heard again and again already in this conference. They're spreading to all the most extraordinary places. This is a remote monastery up near the Chinese border in the very far north of Arunachal Pradesh in India, far from anywhere. Move just a little way from the cow, and you see some memes. Get me, get me, get mobile phones, get. All over the planet you see these things. Satellite dishes everywhere. The whole planet is being connected up into one vast meme machine. Think of it this way. I hope I've now turned your mind inside out sufficient for you to ask yourself whether this is a better way of looking at our planet or not. First, we were infected by life, DNA. Then infected by a second replicator. Both of them are selfish. The second replicator, the memes, is using us to get itself spread, using us to propagate around the planet. It doesn't care about us. We didn't create the internet for our own benefit, although we think we did. It does have some benefits to us, but basically it used us to create itself to spread around the planet. It, the meme world, the memosphere, is sucking up resources at an unprecedented rate, using up all those fossil fuels, damaging the planet, because it doesn't care about what it's doing. It can't, because it's just information being copied by us, the meme machines. This certainly gives us some kind of a responsibility. I don't have any answers, but I can only conclude that I do think it's helpful to look at the world this way, and that's all we can do. Our best hope for the future is to try and understand what's going on.
Brian McClendon, still with Google Earth. This one's a bit scary because it sort of came to me in listening to Sam speak today. I was wondering whether you would consider that the reason that we don't object to moderation is that we're hiding in the shadow of religious conflict, and that America is sort of a peaceful ground where religions and non-religion coexist, and that if we weren't hiding in that shadow, maybe, you know, the religions would fight each other out and we would be wiped out.
Right. Yeah, it's a good question. Clearly we come out of a history of religious intolerance that we should all be very cognizant of. And religious moderation has seemed to be a very auspicious move in light of that. I mean, religious moderates don't fly planes into buildings. They don't kill people for their religious beliefs. Religious moderation consists in not being too sure what happens after death and what God wants for the world. And that's all a very good thing. That is religion chastened by the history of religious conflict and the obvious virtues for a pluralistic world of secular politics. The problem is that the political correctness of religious moderation keeps us blind to some very obvious and rather disastrous processes in our world. I mean, we have people literally blowing themselves up because they think they're going to get to paradise, and we are bewitching ourselves with euphemisms and ideas, as though education in and of itself were an answer to this. I mean, the problem with our educational system, East and West, is that it never opposes this particular species of ignorance and this particular species of irrationality. And it is actually true to say that you can be so well educated now that you could design a nuclear bomb and still think you're going to get into paradise and get 72 virgins. I mean, that is how easily partitioned the human mind is, and how balkanized our culture is, our culture of discourse. And that's, so I think, I mean, I understand the fear there, but we're not getting anywhere not calling a spade at this point.
I don't think that question was for me, so we'll take another one.
Let's take another one down here.
Yes. Sam, I really enjoyed your presentation. I have a question for you, though, about how you define reason and where does intuition fit in that, and is the scientific method the only method for determining whether something is reasonable or not?
Yeah, well, I think we have... we can speak about reason very broadly, and intuition is clearly a part of it. We use the word intuition when we can't break down the steps we have taken cognitively any further. We talk about intuition. Intuition is a word that has been stigmatized in the ivory tower because it's been associated with women's intuition, which means psychic, and you know all kinds of new age. Well, it and broadly, maybe I you know I'm sitting next to a lapsed parapsychologist here, so I won't argue with you on that subject. But clearly intuition is a word that need not be ill-dignified. Mathematicians speak of mathematical intuitions. We have logical intuitions. You know, if I have an object and I throw it out the window, it's either out the window or it's inside. I mean, we all have intuitions, which some branches of science have run roughshod over, and that's why quantum mechanics is so difficult for us to understand in realistic terms, and yet the math works. So we use intuitions to interrogate and revise other intuitions. I mean, our intuitions, quite frankly, statistically are very bad, and you know, most people who are not trained mathematically, if you ask them, if you took a piece of newspaper and folded it in half 100 times, how thick would the object be? Most people imagine something the size of a brick, but you know, a little arithmetic tells you that thing is going to be light years across.
Can I say something about intuition? Yeah. I think it's very important here to as a woman and as a former parapsychologist to separate intuition from the paranormal or from psychic. Maybe in America it means that, but I don't think so. I think women have intuitions that men don't have because various brain differences that we know about. They have more interest in social things and are therefore just a little bit more likely to pick up and have that kind of intuition. I don't like that person. Or I really do like that person. These are not things you can be that you can justify logically, as you said, but they're perfectly normal. They're not weird. And I'm interested in this because I think there's a danger of the skeptics, whether it's skeptics about religion or skeptics about the paranormal, to use rationality as their only ploy. And I guess you were asking a plea, which I would go along with. We need all sorts of other reasonable things, if not rational. Intuition, emotions, human empathy, all sorts of other things to come together as against all this absolute garbage that Sam has exposed for us.
Let me just add one piece to that. There's nothing irrational about love.
Yeah, yes,
there's nothing
exactly
irrational about understanding love, valuing love, seeking to magnify love. If there's a way to learn how to love your neighbor as yourself, it would be perfectly rational for us to try to find out everything we can about that process, biochemically, socially, etc.
I'd like to close with a question that came in electronically for the two of you. Sam, I think we understand completely where you come from, and Sue, I won't presume to know on this subject. Though I have an intuition.
Good.
Human beings are I think by our own measured in human lifespans, human beings are an old species. That is, we've been around for at least a while, and we're an incredibly successful species, and the best extant evidence we have is that we've had religion for a long time. Mm-hmm. So clearly we're doing well. There's more of us than ever before. We're certainly technologically more advanced than we've ever been before. And it seems, and apparently, that we're among the most religious that we've ever been. So in this sense, is there a counter-argument that could be made that, in fact, this is beneficial in its effects?
Right. Well,
There are two
routes into this. One is you just look at the most atheistic societies on the planet now, and by every index of societal health, they are doing the best. I mean, you look at, for instance, the UN Development Index that rates societies by levels of violent crime, literacy, infant mortality, gender equality per capita, GNP, I mean, basically every variable that would interest you as a first pass to look at a society's health, the countries that are healthiest are the countries that have the highest level of atheism. The countries like Sweden and Canada and Australia and Japan and Denmark and the Netherlands. And the United States is an utter outlier in terms of its level of religiosity. If you look within the United States at the states that are most beguiled by their religious literalism and the states where creationism is truly ascendant, these states are plagued by even higher levels of abortion and teen pregnancy and teen STD infection. So the societal indicators tell us otherwise. And at this point, I think rationality itself can tell us otherwise. The marriage of 21st century destructive technology and first century Iron Age ideas, it just seems to me to be on its face a bad idea.
I think the questioner must have been an American, because it only when you come here you see everyone becoming more religious. Yes, we do have some problems in Britain of caused by religion, but on the whole, I mean, I live in a country, I'm very, very grateful to say, where mentioning the word God is sort of embarrassing. Well, other than say, oh my God, you know, that's all right. But I asked my kids when they were at high school, you know, how do you know many people who believe in God? And Jolie said, oh yeah, we've got one in our class. And I said, oh? And she said, yeah, she believes in God, or we give her a bad time. I said, oh, poor girl. I really started feeling sorry for this poor girl. But, you know, my daughter said there were two or three in her class who believed in God. They both admitted that there might be others who just didn't dare own up to it. But that's what it's like in Britain. Owning up to believing in God is, you know, you've got to be a bit brave for that. It's definitely not done. And I come over here and it's totally the opposite. Now, if the science of memetics were better, and oh, I wish it were, we should be able to understand that process. That's precisely what memetics should be good at. Why is it right now in the United States of America that religious memes have got such a grip, whereas in Europe they seem to be fizzling out? And is there a real danger? That's what worries me. I wish I could tell. My kids say, no way, after the kind of schooling we've been through, how are we ever going to be infected by a religion? It couldn't happen. I hope they're right, but I fear they might be wrong. I'm watching your country with interest.
And on that note, let's give our Sue and Sam a terrific round of applause.
You've been listening to a presentation delivered at PopTech 2005, held in Camden, Maine, October 19th through 23rd, 2005. Registered members of the Conversations Network receive a wide variety of benefits. For free membership or to help support our efforts through your donations, visit conversationsnetwork.org. Our audio content is delivered by Limelight Networks, taking the cost and complexity out of internet distribution on the web at limelightnetworks.com. The series producer for our coverage of PopTech is Darusha Wame. The post-production audio engineer for this program was George Hawthorne. Our website editor was... My name is Doug Kay, and I hope you'll join me next time for more of PopTech 2005 here on IT Conversations.